The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's issue is that of last week's. It is dated August 17/August 24, 2020. It has a coronavirus floating, that is, the little viral blobs floating in a sea that is partially submerging the White House. There's a person swimming through the floodwaters toward the White House, and from the back description, wearing a blue suit jacket, one sees only the shoulders and back of the person's head, which is covered with blonde hair. One supposes it could be a caricature of President Trump, and the cover illustration is by Tim O'Brien for Time. The first article, then, is How to Sleep Better. The changing science, business, and culture of a good night's rest. There's a photo illustration by Kanji Kim, and more illustrations by Tommy Perez. And the first illustration looks dusky. There's a rosy color in the sky along with blue and just a sliver of a crescent moon beneath some pink clouds. There's a brick home in the foreground with a tile roof, and it looks rusty colored in this either sunset or top of the morning glow. Sleep, selling sweet dreams from industries to tech travel. They're cashing in by catering to the restless by Kelsey McKinney. And on the facing page, it looks like a desert. Well, actually, it looks like a well-groomed desert. There's a large stretch of white sand with ripples running through it as if some kind of a rake had been drawn across it. In the background, more clouds, another moon, another stratum of blue, and atop that a stratum of gray as if one were looking out an airplane window at a desert horizontally and a sky and clouds and moon horizontally as well. In a small room without windows, I am instructed to breathe in sync with a colorful bar on a screen in front of me, six counts in, six counts out, electrodes tie me to a machine whirring on the table. My hands and feet are bare, wiped clean, and placed atop silver boards. My finger is pinched by an oximeter, my left arm squeezed by a blood pressure cuff. Across from me, a woman with a high ponytail, scrub-like attire, and soft eyes smiles encouragingly. She is not a doctor, and this is not a lab. The air smells like lavender, and another fruity scent I later learn is cassis, C-A-S-S-I-S. My chair is made of woven reeds topped with a thick cushion and a pillow for lumbar support. The windowless room feels more cozy than claustrophobic. This is not torture, but a luxury. I am, in fact, in a five-star resort with a 2,000-square-meter spa and an indoor heated pool. This process I've been promised will help me sleep better. For years, I had been waking up exhausted. My primary care doctor ran my blood work three separate times to try to suss out an underlying problem, and each time it came back fine. I had no problem falling asleep or even really staying asleep. The problem was, no matter how many hours of sleep I got, I had to haul myself out of bed in the morning, grumpy and lethargic. So in December, before COVID-19 ravaged the world and made travel unsafe, I journeyed to a beautiful valley in Portugal's port wine region to take part in the 220 euro per night Six Senses Sleep Retreat to try to learn to sleep better. six senses has long made wellness and sustainability two of its main pillars of business. They have yoga retreats and infrared spas. They are aiming to be plastic-free by 2020. All plastic, not just single use. But for the past 2 years, the luxury resort brand has bet big on sleep. In 2017, they launched a sleep program with a sleep coach, sleep monitoring, wellness screening, bedtime tea service, and a goodie bag of sleep health supplies. The idea was that with 3 nights of analysis and behavioral adjustments, I might finally train my body to get a good night's sleep. It is a vacation with a purpose, and it's one with a big appeal. Six Senses offers the program at 10 of its resorts and is requiring all new resorts, including New York City in 2021, to include the program. Luxury hotels have been pushing health as a selling point for travel since well before events made the two oxymoronic. The global wellness tourism market was valued at $683.3 billion in 2018 by Grand View Research. And according to the Global Wellness Institute's 2018 report, 830 million wellness trips were taken by travelers in 2017. That was up nearly 17% from 2015. In 2018, American Airlines partnered with the meditation app Calm to help their passengers sleep. Headspace has partnerships with 7 different airlines to do the same thing all over the past few years. A survey from the National Institutes of Health shows that the number of U.S. adults who reported meditating while traveling tripled from 2012 through 2017. And all this travel wellness has one common goal, to get people to sleep better, because we know that, generally, people are not sleeping well. In 2016, the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, published findings claiming 1/3 of adults are not getting enough sleep, and that sleep deprivation is costing the country some $400 billion each year in productivity. It's also important to note many studies have found a large disparity in sleep quality based on race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic status. In comparisons of white and black populations, studies have found that white women have the best sleep duration and black men the worst. Those disparities do not go away when studies adjust for socioeconomic level. The Sleep Foundation writes that a factor may be higher levels of stress because of discrimination in daily life. Although consumers have opened their wallets in pursuit of better sleep since the debut of memory foam in 1966, the past 5 years have been a boom for the sleep wellness industry. The global sleeping products market brought in $69.5 billion in revenue in 2017, and according to the most recent report published in May 2018 by P&S Market Research, the industry is on track to hit $101.9 billion in 2023. The consulting group McKinsey put out a 7-page guide to investing in sleep health in 2017. And anyone who's tried to buy a mattress online recently has noticed just how many new mattress brands there are. Casper, Tuft and Needle, Purple, Lisa, Allswell, Sleep Choices, Bear. That's B-E-A-R. The U.S. mattress industry has doubled in value since 2015, from $8 billion to $16 billion. In my desperate quest for good sleep, I've bought into all of this. When I sat down to calculate it all, I was stunned to find that over the past 3 years, I've spent more than $1,000 on sleep. I bought a Fitbit, a Sonos speaker with a built-in alarm, a new pillow, a new mattress, a fluffier comforter, a weighted blanket, cold eye masks, a humidifier, pajamas made of bamboo, pajamas made of 100% cotton, pajamas made of satin, and an alarm clock that mimics a sunrise. The sleep retreat, I hoped, would do something all the other purchases had not. I do not sleep well on the plane. After 4 hours of fitful slumber, interrupted by turbulence, dinner service, and my seat neighbor bumping into me on the red eye from New York City to Lisbon, I groggily deplane and replane for the short flight to Porto, down another espresso, and drive the 1.5 hours to the Douro Valley. By the time I arrive at the hotel, the sun is beginning to set, and my bed looks very inviting. It is only 5 p.m. I'm led to my room by a woman named Vera, who introduces my supplies. An eye mask, bamboo pajamas, earplugs, lavender spray for my bed, and a worry journal where I can write down anything bothering me before I sleep. I flop down on the 2,500 euro mattress and hope that whatever I learn here will be easily transferable to the $200 mattress I bought off Amazon and my sad cotton blend sheets. By the bed is a small box made by ResMed, which will track my movements while I sleep and present me with colorful graphs of data each morning. I follow the given instructions, eat dinner leisurely, have only one glass of wine, take a bath in the deep tub, drink chamomile tea, put on the new pajamas, write in the journal, and go to bed around 10 p.m. When I wake up, the ResMed app shows a series of colorful bars, my sleep architecture progression through deep REM, R-E-M, and light sleep, and a score of 97. I had nothing to say about that sleep, shrugs Javier Suarez, director of the spa and wellness programs at Douro Valley, at my first consultation. He studied physiotherapy at the University of California, San Francisco, UCSF, and he knows this is abnormally good. What we often see here is the first night guests sleep bad because they come jet-lagged or they are anxious, he says. I'd slept a hard, uninterrupted 8 hours. I feel proud of the prep I did before I came, adjusting my bedtime to try to prevent jet lag. There are many scientific reasons to desire good sleep. Poor sleep quality is associated with a whole host of unhealthy side effects. Getting bad sleep puts people at a higher risk for diabetes, cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's, impaired memory, problem-solving issues, fatigue, anxiety, mood disturbances, and poor performance at work. There is a market, then, to help people sleep better, not just because it makes money, but also because it's generally good for people. There is no wellness without good sleep. Forget about it, Suarez tells me. If you do not make sleep your priority, then you will not be healthy. The Global Wellness Institute attributes the growing wellness industry to 4 things, an aging population, increased global rates of chronic disease, and stress, the negative health impacts of environmental degradation, and the frequent failures of modern Western medicine. In the case of insomniacs, the ever-popular sleep drugs, Ambien, Lunesta, Sonata, and others, received black box warnings from the FDA, the agency's most serious caution, in May 2019. Those turned off by the foreboding packaging may turn to more holistic sleep wellness methods. Sleep scientists have also been working to better publicize their research on the benefits of sleep hygiene. In 2013, the CDC and American Academy of Sleep Medicine launched the National Healthy Sleep Awareness Project, which aimed to raise public knowledge of sleep disorders and the ways sleep affects health. In March, 4 months after my visit to the sleep retreat, COVID-19 began to spread in the U.S., and the dream felt further away than ever. Several of my friends got sick, and I stopped sleeping. Then the Black Lives Matter protests began, and I continued to sleep fitfully, worried for my friends and fellow citizens. This time, though, I knew what mistakes I was making. I knew that stress was keeping me awake, bolstered by scrolling through my phone for news updates till 11 p.m., not exercising, having another glass of wine. I knew all that, but I was too stressed to stop. One night, in a sleepless haze, I swiped away from the news and found myself browsing my old online shopping haunts. I added lavender spray and a new set of pajamas to my cart and clicked Buy Now. And that article was abridged. Under the heading Time Off Opener, here is an essay, Television Now, Heal Thyself by Judy Berman. If you have watched any amount of reality TV, you've witnessed a scene like the one that closes the series premiere of TBS's Lost Resort. A beautiful 20-something woman, surrounded by scenery straight out of the Garden of Eden, screams her heart out. Her hot castmates look on helplessly, wearing skimpy athleisure and concerned expressions. On The Bachelor, this kind of meltdown would probably be about competing for a mate. The amazing race and its ilk force exhausted contestants to work together to complete challenges designed to incite conflict. But in Lost Resort, the meltdown is the challenge. The series transports 9 people to a resort in the Costa Rican jungle on what it describes as a journey of self-discovery in the care of an eclectic team of alternative healers. In this instance, we're observing something called a rage ritual, and in a broader sense, one of the sillier manifestations of a new trend in reality TV, the wellness show. Wellness is, of course, a massive cultural force unto itself. Too tenacious to be a trend, it's more like a new lifestyle paradigm for youngish, relatively affluent Westerners willing to pay a premium for high-end products, treatments, and experiences, all in the pursuit of practices from yoga to ayahuasca shamanism that mostly originated in the global South. The Global Wellness Institute, a nonprofit umbrella organization for the $4.5 trillion industry, defines wellness as the active pursuit of activities, choices, and lifestyles that lead to a state of holistic health. Gwyneth Paltrow, whose Goop empire sits at the perilous crossroads of media and e-commerce, is perhaps the most famous face of contemporary wellness culture. This winter, she unveiled Netflix's The Goop Lab with Gwyneth Paltrow, a docu-series in which she and her staff test a suite of buzzy practices. Also on Netflix, Down to Earth with Zac Efron sends the actor around the world with his buddy Darren Olean, whom Efron describes as a guru of healthy living and superfoods. On a bro trip focused on wellness, food, and conservation, the investigative series Unwell, coming to Netflix, or that came to Netflix August 12, will either balance out the aforementioned fluff or further confuse viewers. YouTube original game show Sleeping with Friends challenges YouTube personalities to improve their sleep hygiene, and HBO Max recently announced it would partner with the popular app Calm on A World of Calm, a series that will enlist performers like Mahershala Ali, Nicole Kidman, and Keanu Reeves to narrate episodes designed to soothe. Diverse though they are, all wellness shows share one enticement, the possibility of transformation for subjects on screen, the viewer, or both. This is hardly a new theme. Ovid's Metamorphoses is written into the DNA of Western storytelling, from Shakespeare's The Tempest to My Fair Lady, just as it was in that musical, not to mention in so many teen movies. Physical transformation was a favorite trope of reality series in the 00s. But since then, an increased awareness of the dark side of reality TV and a surge in pop feminism have put an end to most makeover shows. The new wave of wellness shows is not just tapping into a novel market, it is also satisfying our hunger for transformation stories. But is the spectacle of rage rituals really nourishing viewers' bodies or souls more than what came before it? Reality TV was a wild west in the early 21st century, and horrific concepts outnumbered brilliant ones. ABC's Extreme Makeover spent 4 seasons combining the acute pain of cosmetic surgery with the prolonged agony of brutal diets and exercise regimens to transform regular people into supermodels. With 2004's short-lived The Swan, Fox upped the ante by restricting its ugly duckling cast to women and pitting the gut-renovated subjects against one another in a beauty pageant. In her book, Reality Bites Back, critic Jennifer L. Posner called it the most sadistic reality series of the decade. Gentler makeover stuck around longer, TLC stalwart What Not to Wear, in which hosts Stacey London and Clinton Kelly cheerfully upgraded the wardrobes of the sartorially clueless, limited cosmetic intervention to hair and makeup. But the show still fed on the mostly female participants' insecurities, implying any woman who failed to conform to external beauty standards must want to change. London revamped her approach for 2015's Love, Lust, or Run. I am not out to change them, she told HuffPost of her subjects. I don't want them to blend in. They aren't necessarily meant to look conventional. Network executives also found new ways to cash in on Americans' obsession with weight loss. NBC's long-running hit, The Biggest Loser, tantalized viewers with the opportunity to watch obese people dramatically transform their bodies through a hellish program of calorie restrictions and hours of daily exercise. Under the supervision of trainers, many contestants would lose upwards of 100 pounds in a few months. Hospitalizations, horror stories, and a chorus of criticism from medical professionals suggested the show was exploiting its casts more than helping them. Loser disappeared in 2016 after a widely publicized study found contestants were regaining pounds because rapid weight loss had slowed their metabolisms. This winter, the show resurfaced on USA amid a TV landscape that's ravenous for content but starved for ideas. The contrite Loser promised to focus on sustainable lifestyle changes, incorporating therapy and nutrition. Though critics did not all agree that this makeover was extreme enough, USA and Sci-Fi Network's head Chris McCumber touted Loser 2.0 as a holistic 360-degree look at wellness. The wellness show is, on its scrupulously moisturized face, more humane than the makeover show. It often involves celebrities who would never endanger their reputations by airing out their homeliest undergarments on TV because wellness culture is a magnet for people whose livelihoods depend on staying youthful and attractive. The stated aim of these shows is to help people, not humiliate them. Watching this stuff is supposed to feel good, not dirty. Unfortunately, the effectiveness and safety of many disciplines that fall under the enormous umbrella of wellness varies widely. Wellness culture includes such research-backed practices as yoga and meditation. It also encompasses alternative therapies like crystal healing, whose utility is limited to the placebo effect. At its fringes are harmful, demonstrably false beliefs like those promoted by the ACT anti-vaccine movement. But even legitimate corners of the wellness world can be cultish, hyper-commercialized, emptily aspirational. Wellness shows reflect that range. Sleeping with friends is pretty careful, offering time-tested wisdom like avoiding screens before bed. Series like Goop Lab and Down to Earth can be much flakier. Efron's alternately goofy and philosophical narration creates the impression that he's just as sanguine about the possibility that water from Lourdes' famous spring can cure cancer as he is about the promise of geothermal energy. Paltrow's come under fire for selling women expensive products that could hurt them. In 2019, a woman sustained second-degree burns from vaginal steaming, a treatment Goop had endorsed, and her show fails to meaningfully distinguish between research-supported science and forays into ridiculous topics like psychic mediumship. Lost Resort, for its part, blurs the line between non-judgmental therapy and mean-spirited entertainment. The show professes to care about its participants, some of them, like a woman who can't stop mourning her stillborn baby, do evoke empathy. Others are edited to fit the contours of classic reality TV villains. And it is hard to know how seriously we're supposed to take the healers. Onika, who teaches meditation to incarcerated people, seems pretty legit, but the retreat's leader is a woman named Chrissy Fire Main, an expert in shamanic psychotherapy with a fondness for finger symbols. Benjamin does not exactly refute the viewer's suspicion that the show cast healers based on appearance. "Your body's your temple," he opens. "I was blessed to have a temple that's 6'4" and has nice hair and develops muscles well." Set pieces like the rage ritual land more as manufactured drama than as effective treatments for cast members, whose issues range from anger management to detachment from emotions. Wellness is a complicated topic. Genteel framing aside, the shoddy science and subliminal lifestyle marketing that underlie so many wellness shows could be more dangerous than the transformation porn of makeover programs. And while reality TV might sometimes educate us or inspire empathy, its chief function will always be to entertain. Anyone who says differently probably has some snake oil to sell you. From Time Off Reviews, Movies, a spiky delight straight from the old country. By Stephanie Zakarik. Even as our political landscape has become overloaded with ridiculously wrong-headed pronouncements, comic absurdity in the movies, dumb or even smart stuff that just makes you laugh, feels more precious than ever. We've all become worried Victorian orphans facing our glum future. R.I.P. delight. It was nice while it lasted. But wait. Seth Rogen, as an early 20th century pickle company grunt, who falls into a vat of brine and emerges perfectly preserved in modern-day Brooklyn? Did someone actually conceive that as a movie idea, let alone get the thing made? The good news for you and me, my fellow Juan Victorian orphans, is that An American Pickle is a real movie, and it is delightful. Sometimes a logically indefensible premise is the only thing that makes life seem logical. Rogan plays a dual role here. He is, first, Herschel Greenbaum, native of the Eastern European region of Schlupsk, a land of mud and hardship. We first meet Herschel in 1919 as he woos a local girl, Sarah Snook. She has all her teeth, top and bottom, he notes approvingly. Both have tragic backgrounds, alluded to in dashes of black humor. Her parents were murdered by Cossacks. My parents were murdered by Cossacks. And when yet more violence strikes their village, they set out for America, eager to start a family that will stretch forth through generations. Then Herschel falls into the vat. He awakens, still wearing his rumpled cap and sporting his scraggly beard, to learn his beloved wife is long dead. His feelings of displacement stir anger in his heart. Then he learns he has one living relative, a great-grandson, Ben Greenbaum, Rogan again. Ben whisks Herschel to his nerd bachelor Brooklyn apartment, introducing him to the wonders of Alexa and the miracle of SodaStream. Seltzer was an unaffordable luxury in the old country, as well as teaching him the new dance steps, though Herschel has retained some pretty fly fiddler on the roof moves. This is the assertively heartwarming part of an American pickle. But not to worry, it does not last long. Herschel is Ben's only connection to family. Ben's father, Herschel's grandson, has died in a car crash, as has Ben's mother. But before long, Herschel and Ben, a failed app developer who also, it appears, harbors anger in his heart, have a falling out. Herschel strikes out on his own and becomes a pickle cart mogul. Ben, jealous and spiteful, tries to sabotage him. It becomes clear that neither is particularly nice, and certainly not to each other. Yet their faults unite them, and their stumbling odyssey back toward each other is what gives an American pickle its spiky warmth. Directed by Brandon Trost and adapted by Simon Rich from his own novella, Sell Out, an American pickle has an acidic zing that neutralizes any sentimentality. Rogan has a great feel for Yiddish humor, for its lilting rhythms and its joy, but also for its bleakness. When Herschel learns that Ben's lost his parents, he says with genuine compassion, "I'm very sorry," before asking, "Murder or regular?" But Rogan can carry the movie's more serious threads, too. While Ben claims he's not religious, he comes to understand that even among the non-observant, religion can be the thread that connects families through centuries. Rogan, Trost, and Rich have a sense of how ridiculous and sometimes punishing life can seem. In 1919 or in 2020, yet even without the advantage of being preserved in brine, we get through the madness. Laheim. Time off. Books. Nonfiction. The Truth About Jesus' Wife by Lucas Whitman. For a moment back in 2012, readers around the world might have thought Jesus had had a wife. Karen King, an esteemed professor at Harvard University's Divinity School, made headlines when she revealed what she named the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, a small fragment of papyrus with 8 cryptic, incomplete lines in Coptic, including, "Jesus said to them, 'My wife.'" The journalist, Ariel Sabar, was on hand in Rome for her attention-grabbing announcement, which seized the media's attention, including this magazine, thanks to the tantalizing possibility of an entirely different Christian history, one in which Mary Magdalene, the possible wife in question, was even more central to Jesus' story. King's discovery had the potential to upend a millennia-old male-centric history. King said at the time, "My own faith and the faith of other Christians is best built on good history." But that is not exactly what she was presenting to the world, as Sabar examines in his new book, Veritas, a Harvard professor, a con man, and the Gospel of Jesus' Wife. as she had done previously in her original and acclaimed work on the Gnostic Gospels, King told a brilliant alternate history, neatly packaged and ready for prime time. But this time there was one problem. It was not true. Even before she went public with her discovery, some scholars and papyrologists questioned the authenticity of the fragment. Then the furor died down a bit until 2014, when a publication in an esteemed journal of theological history seemed to confirm that the papyrus might be real. But by 2016, thanks to Savar's reporting in The Atlantic and a growing list of rebuttals from Coptic experts and scientists, it was clear that the fragment was nothing more than a bad forgery, cobbled together from publicly available Gnostic texts with sloppy penmanship. King finally admitted that she had been duped. Sabar revealed in his reporting that the text had originally been brought to King by Walter Fritz, a failed German student of Egyptology and director of the Stasi Museum turned Florida-based, wife-swapping pornographer. The mystery of Fritz and why King did not fully investigate the provenance of this scrap is at the center of Veritas. It is a story about journalism done right, about Savar's own capable dogged sleuthing to get to the bottom of those famous headlines. Along the way, Savar explores the history of alternate Christian texts, the eccentric scholars who investigate them, and the internal workings of Harvard. In our moment of truthiness, to borrow a term from Stephen Colbert, Veritas offers a vital lesson about Christianity, then about what happens when a scholar decides that the story's more important than the truth. King had spent her career presenting an important scholarly narrative about the need to reevaluate and reinterpret the canonical story of Christianity, to allow for women to play a central role, and to question some of the central tenets of how established churches told the world's most famous story. But in Sabar's convincing and damning assessment, when it came to Jesus' wife, she bypassed the facts, ignored peers who warned her something was amiss, and failed to thoroughly interrogate how Fritz had come to possess this stunning artifact. One can imagine the appeal of the moment, the chance to inspire a frank discussion about who gets to be at the center of the story of Christian truth. By the end of Veritas, the readers left wishing King had stuck to her own vision of good history and asked the hard questions before she went public. Instead, she let a papyrus scrap obscure the larger point she had been making for decades. Six questions. This is adapted from a Time 100 talk. Bill Gates, the tech magnate turned philanthropist, on the U.S. response to COVID-19, prospects for a vaccine, and how to share it. This pandemic seems a little different in that the U.S. does not seem to be serving as a model for how to best respond. What has been responsible for that? Now, I will announce these answers, all of them by Bill Gates. If you score the U.S., our domestic response has been weak but can improve. Our R&D response, funding vaccines and therapeutics, has been the best in the world. And then in the third category, making those tools available to the world, we are hoping this supplemental bill, 1% to the resources, would be enough to have a pretty dramatic effect and get other countries to give, so that one's incomplete still. Question: how do you think government leaders can better work with public health leaders to learn from the lessons of Ebola, HIV, and previous influenza outbreaks? Answer from Mr. Gates. Well, it is amazing the contrast to Ebola. The U.S. allocated money and went and helped out, even though the threat of that to the U.S. itself was very, very minor. Here we have not yet shown up in the international forums, where the money to get these tools out to countries is being discussed. That still absolutely can be fixed. The private sector left all by itself would simply charge the highest price and only give to the very wealthy. When you use the private sector, which is where the deep expertise is, you have to use them in the right way. And that's not being done. It can't just be a pure market-driven thing. Question. The Gates Foundation is one of the largest funders of vaccine research around the world. How can we ensure that vaccine trials are successful? Answer from Mr. Gates. The political pressure to move quickly is not a perfect thing. Even calling the thing Operation Warp Speed, talking about going around certain Food and Drug Administration guidelines. So far, the staff, the non-political staff, has held the line that we really have to prove efficacy and have the full safety database, and that we're not going to go off like we did with hydroxychloroquine and give it emergency use when there was no serious data to suggest there was anything there. It was purely political, sort of like a wives' tale type of thing. We really cannot do that with the vaccine. Question. Are you confident that the fall will not be as disastrous as this summer? Answer. Strangely, the death rate this summer has not gotten up to the peak death rate, and it is partly because we do have remdesivir and dexamethasone. There are things the medical profession, with lots of heroes and great thinking, does to reduce the death rate. So the fall is a mix for me, where the innovation track is the good news that could bring things down, but a lack of social distancing, that one hangs in the balance. Question, how confident are you that vaccine manufacturing and distribution will provide a vaccine to everyone who needs one? Answer, as yet the U.S. has not spoken up on its willingness to help the developing countries here, like the U.S. has done in every other global health thing. I'm hopeful the supplemental bill, like 1% of it, will go to people like Gavi and Global Fund, who bring us that health equity. And the sixth and last question, are you optimistic about how we will manage this pandemic? Mr. Gates' response, I think the U.S. response will improve. I think the innovation will come along. I think U.S. generosity will show up to help the world on this. I mean, it is a huge setback. The only good thing that will come out of this is we will advance some technologies that will help us be ready for a future pandemic and will help us with other diseases. But I was one of the voices that said we should be ready for this. We were not ready for it. And the price of that will be very high. But we will get past it. This article, Six Questions with Bill Gates, was written by Alice Park, and a black and white photograph of Mr. Gates is apparent in the center of this page. He's wearing a dark suit, white shirt, or very light colored. He's wearing a medium colored tie, and the two sides or the two ends are not matching. But his jacket is not closed either. He's smiling at the camera. His hair is not real short. It looks gray, or at least it has a light tint to it. And he is wearing dark-framed glasses. The police are a broken legacy of a racist system and tasked with work they are not trained to do. It is time to radically rethink public safety in America by Josiah Bates, Camden, New Jersey, and Carl Vick, Minneapolis. This is under the heading Nation. In Minneapolis, the first days after George Floyd's killing exist in memory as a kind of blur. Even so, the burning of the 3rd Precinct Police Station, May 28, was a signal event, not only for residents of the South Side where Floyd was killed and so many buildings went up in flames. 5 miles to the north, residents of the city's other substantially black area worried the chaos was coming their way. That night, Philippe Cunningham, a city council member representing part of North Minneapolis, drove around for 2.5 hours without seeing any cops at all. They were hunkered in their stations. In the void they had left, a community stepped up. On Emerson Avenue, gang members took pride of place in the phalanx, guarding the So Low grocery outlet, one of the North Side's only two supermarkets. "We locked it down for 7 nights," says the Reverend Jerry McAfee, a Baptist preacher who works with gangs. Members of his patrol were identifiable by green and white bandanas and weapons not necessarily displayed. "Here's what I can tell you," McAfee says. "Fort Knox was not guarded any better." In an integrated neighborhood 1.5 miles away, unarmed residents in orange tees formed a perimeter around the other supermarket. Night after night, they challenged the white youths, circling the block in pickup trucks without license plates, vetted unknown volunteers, and, it dawned on more than one of them, edged toward an approach to public safety that might supplant the deeply flawed one that had provoked the mayhem around them. What could replace the police? The question, until recently confined to activist circles, has been forced into national debate by a brutal logic. If the killing of Floyd truly left Americans with a resolve to address systemic racism in the country, shouldn't the starting point be the system that produced his excruciating death? Almost 2 weeks after now former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck, the Minneapolis City Council concluded its police department was beyond reform and must instead be replaced. In a unanimous vote, the council embarked on a year-long quest to produce a new model for cultivating safety in our city, explicitly steered by the desires of the people most oppressed by the current one. If Minneapolis produces a new safety paradigm, the implications will be profound, reaching beyond the horror of police killings toward a rethinking of a criminal justice system lamented by liberals and conservatives alike. If it fails, a status quo deeply rooted in the control of black bodies will remain the norm, and this will have been a nice little moment in history where we almost did something, says Jeremiah Ellison, a council member for Minneapolis's North Side. Resident safety hangs in the balance, and so does a movement so new it still needs a good name. Though Minneapolis council members linked themselves to defund police by announcing their bold initiative, while standing behind letters spelled out the protest slogan, their ambition cannot be summed up in 2 words, much less 2 words with the potential to be so easily misunderstood. To succeed, the movement needs a more precise slogan than defund to capture an actual intention that's been all but impossible to articulate because it comes, for now, from another world, one that acknowledges that black lives matter. "We are in a time of theorizing," says Oluchio Mioga, a co-founder of the Minneapolis activist group, Black Visions Collective. "We are trying to build a world that does not yet exist." In that world, the core mission of public safety is not enforcement, but care. And a call to 911 is more likely to produce a specialist in the problem at hand than a police officer carrying a gun, 15 pounds of gear, and the additional weight of 3 centuries of radicalized law enforcement. The new system would look for solutions from the very communities that the old system regarded as sources of problems and guide investment accordingly. Law enforcement would not disappear. Not in a country with more guns than people, but the officers who remained would be highly professional and trained in an ethos of valuing life. They would be focused on solving people's problems rather than locking people up, and would work alongside those they serve. Countless hours have been spent in the past few weeks discussing what's gone wrong in policing, but Minneapolis voters may take action as early as November. in the form of a referendum that would allow city lawmakers to continue exploring a new approach to safety. Everyone already knows it's going to be hard. Camden, New Jersey, a city more than 1,000 miles away, has been held up by as many as an illustration of what the existing model can be. But the experiences of citizens there reveal not just the potential for real change, but also the limits of what's been possible, at least so far, while still keeping residents safe. As an elected official, I will not make any decisions whatsoever that will decrease safety, says Cunningham. Everything I do is about increasing the safety of the residents, and it is very clear that this system we have now is not doing that. One thing the system does have is longevity. Today's models of policing in the U.S. can be traced back hundreds of years, and with them an understanding of why, in 2020, according to the database Mapping Police Violence, a black person is 3 times as likely as a white person to be killed by police. In America's early years, towns protected themselves informally, with the help of a part-time night watch. Though night watchmen were notorious for simply using their shifts to get drunk. The country's first publicly funded police department started in Boston in 1838 with the primary goal of protecting property. But in some places, property included human beings. In this country, for the years that cover the 1600s to the mid-19th century, the most dominant presence of law enforcement was what we call today slave patrols. That is what made up policing, Harvard history professor Khalil Gibran Muhammad told NPR this year. These patrols were tasked with providing swift punishment for runaways and enslaved people who broke the rules, and assuaging the white population's fear of a revolt. Long after the Civil War, sheriff's departments administered slavery's postbellum byproducts, segregation and Jim Crow oppression. During World War II, after thousands of African Americans moved to Oakland, California, to find work in the shipyards, the city responded by recruiting Southern police officers. In the post-war boom, redlining, which prevented home loans from going to black people, enforced segregation of neighborhoods, and denied black people home ownership, the primary route to middle-class wealth. Maintaining that system reinforced the imperative of the slave patrol, vigilant oversight of a population perceived as threatening, despite, or perhaps because of, its being oppressed. The modern civil rights movement in the 1960s changed laws, but not the fundamental nature of policing. Black and brown people have been disproportionately targeted by programs like the New York Police Department's Street Stop effort known as Stop and Frisk, which a federal judge ruled in 2013 was used in an unconstitutional way. The past few months have served as a searing reminder of how those dynamics play out in today's society. As protesters took to the streets, speaking out against racism and law enforcement violence, some departments seemed to prove their point. In New York City in May, police drove an SUV into a group of demonstrators. In Philadelphia, police tear gassed protesters trapped in a channeled roadway. The recent militarization of local police, with departments nationwide receiving armored vehicles left over from wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, obscures more than the faces of officers. The truth is, cops rarely confront violent crime. Cadets spend most of their average 21 weeks of training on defensive tactics and firearms. But time use studies find patrol officers mostly deal with traffic, medical calls, accidentally tripped burglar alarms, arguments, and the like. In 1999, when Baltimore was called the most violent city in America, its mayor said its police spend 11% of their time on crime, half of that not serious. In smaller places, studies have found all crime occupied 7% to less than 1% of an officer's time. There is a mismatch between how we've constructed cops and what they actually do, concludes New York University law professor Barry Friedman in a 70-page paper he wrote in March titled Disaggregating the Police Function. Officers are not only unequipped to handle what former Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn has called the intractable social problems that are dumped in the laps of our 25 to 30-year-old first responders. They also arrive heavy with the tools of forceful control, baton, taser, firearm. Thanks to redlining and its reverberations, the neighborhoods where those social problems tend to run especially deep are often those where black and brown people have been confined. And, as Philip Ottabagoff, co-founder and CEO of the Center for Policing Equity, a think tank focused on addressing racial gaps in law enforcement impacts, points out, they're also the areas that tend to be highly policed. Black and Hispanic people are more likely than white people to have multiple interactions with the police. It is a dangerous mix and has left many minority communities with scant reason to view the police as allies, especially in the years since smartphones made it easy to share high-quality video. The world's been treated to a view of a problem that's much older than that technology. Whether it's an officer caught on camera shooting someone in the back or using a chokehold. Such incidents define policing for black Americans, and beneath the headline-making moments caught on video lie policies from the Fugitive Slave Act to stop and frisk. This article was abridged. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. Again, the number is 919-832-5138.